Today, the title of the message is The Reward. Just two words, shorter than normal for me, is The Reward. Now, you might have seen on CNN this past November 18th, title of an article, UK teenager, and this is United Kingdom, teenager wins battle to have body cryogenically frozen. So this means placed in liquid nitrogen as soon as possible after death, minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit. So she won a battle to have her body frozen. A judge at the High Court in London granted the final wishes of a 14-year-old girl to be cryogenically preserved. So it's a sad story. Obviously, this girl suffered from a rare form of cancer and wanted to be frozen in case she could be cured in the future. And we know that's not going to work. When you die, the spirit leaves the body, so it's not there anymore. This body is just a vehicle right now for that spirit that God has placed within us. You know, I suppose when she awakens in the second resurrection, she's going to think, it worked. It worked. It's an interesting thought. And I'm speaking to a group today who understand that those seeking the first resurrection would have no interest in cryogenic freezing. It's not something that's going to help. It's not something we need. And this girl did die on October 17th. She wrote shortly before death, I have been asked to explain why I want this unusual thing to done. I'm only 14 years old and I don't want to die, but I know I am going to. So that is sad. There are some cancers we just can't do much with. I think being cryopreserved gives me a chance. She's holding on to the hope that she has, and it is a small hope. Gives me a chance to be cured and woken up, even in hundreds of years' time. It's going to be a bit over 1,000 years for this young lady, however. I don't want to be buried underground. I want to live and live longer, and I think that in the future they might find a cure for my cancer and wake me up. I want to have this chance. This is my wish. Think how happy she will be when she's awakened and realize I am back to life. Her slim hope, and really it's no hope at all, is in contrast to that of a first fruit, a member of God's present small flock. Let's look in 1 John 3 and see some of this hope. 1 John 3, verses 1 to 2 there. Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. And this is one of those verses where you can step back and say, there's a lot in there, what I just read. This is the Almighty Creator of everything. Incredibly, incredibly powerful being. Behold what manner of love this being has for us, that we should be called His children, children of God. Therefore the world does not know us. How much does it connect with people when you talk about first fruits? When you talk about atonement or Feast of Tabernacles, therefore the world does not know us because it did not know Him. And they don't yet, and it makes a very big difference. And I have to stop at work now and then because there's really no need to go on because they don't have the platform to understand what I would like to be able to say. Verse 2, behold, now we are children of God. And that's talking about this small group sitting here today. And it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him. That's another big one. That message there. For, and we shall see Him like He is at that time. What will it be like? To be like what we just read about, to be like Christ. There's many places we could look, but let's look in Exodus. Exodus 33. And we'll have a little picture of when that happens, when this resurrection occurs, we will be like Him. Exodus 33 and verse 11. Exodus 33:11, so the Lord spoke to Moses. That's capital L and then smaller capital O-R-D, and we know that's the eternal, that's Jehovah, that's Yahweh. This is the Creator, this is Christ speaking here before he became Christ. This is also God, it's one of the two God beings. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Isn't there, again, just a lot there, sitting with God and talking with him as a man speaks to his friend? And Moses knew a lot about Christ. He knew who he was. He knew he was visiting with a toned-down version of what Christ really was. And this will be like it will be in the millennium. When you come back to help people, you can't come back in full force. It's more than they can deal with. It will be a toned-down version. And Moses knew this. And in verse 18, he said, "Please show me your glory." In other words, I want to see what you really look like. There's a lot of glory in these Bibles. I noticed Mr. McCurdy just talked about the glory of the physical temple and then compared that to the glory of the spiritual temple. It struck me how much I was seeing this word as I was working on this message. Please show me your glory. I looked up the definition. High renown or honor, magnificence, great beauty. This is what Moses wanted to see. I want to see who you are, who you really are. Please show me your glory. But he, Christ, God said, "You cannot see my face. No man shall see me and live. You would be vaporized if I did that. You cannot stand before me in my glory as I really am." And the Lord said, "Here's a place. Look, there's a cleft on this rock right beside us here. And you stand on the rock, and so shall it be while my glory passes, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not or shall not be seen." Christ's face in his glory is as bright as the sun in full strength. And God says to his present physical children, what do we just see in 1 John 3? "When I come back, you will be like me. You shall be like me." One day you'll be very different in glory. No back pain, no cancer, no other diseases. Beautiful immortality of peace, supreme strength, supreme goodness and happiness. Magnificence is what we're talking about here. In addition to a spirit body, which is a wonderful thing to think about, such an exciting thing to think about, but I wanted to have some fun today and consider another aspect of the reward. I gave a sermonette on this topic maybe 5-6 years ago, I don't remember. And then at the feast in Puerto Vallarta, Mr. David Holliday, something about the name of that guy I just like. I'm not sure what it is. I say that when I meet Mr. Elliott. I know I can trust you. Something about that name. Mr. David Holliday did the same or similar at the feast in Puerto Vallarta. And this always makes me think back to when I was sitting on the driveway, our house in Virginia up in the mountains, and it was after dark, but it was summer, it was warm, and I was sitting there with son Jeremy at the time, and he was quite a bit younger, and the stars were beautiful before us, and looking at those, I commented, God has placed our future right before our eyes, a very big part of our eternity, rather than sitting in heaven and playing a harp and not really knowing what we're going to be doing. That was my comment. What does the Bible say about the time when the saints receive their spirit bodies? Those bodies we just reflected on a little bit in the resurrection. Let's look in Romans 8. To me, it just is kind of skin tingling at times when you look at these things and what God is telling us. Romans 8, verse 16. 16 to 19, the Spirit itself, we know should be there, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are, and here we see it again, we are children of God, of the Almighty God. I think I'm going to shake top of this podium off up here. It spins a little bit. Verse 17, and if children, then heirs, Okay, there's a lot there again. We're heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, if we follow him, if we answer our calling, that we may also be glorified. Here's this word again, glorified, glory together. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory, the magnificence, the beauty, the strength, which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. And if we explore that word creation, other translations say the whole creation, all of creation, the universe. The New English Bible says for the created universe. Everything, everything physical out there waits with eager expectations for God's sons to be revealed. Who created this universe anyway? And this is where modern Christianity, we just didn't know. Obviously God did, but no, that's correct, but it's not the way they're thinking. I won't go there, but John 1:3 states, all things were made by him. Made by him, and this is referring to Christ. And without him was not anything made that was made. Paul provided the same message as John, that Christ was the creator. We could go to Colossians, I won't do that. 1:16, for by him, this is Christ. I sure didn't know this before I came into the church, were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth. Visible and invisible, all things were created by him and for him. So the word translated as heaven in this verse is not God's domain. And obviously Christ didn't create God. And it just said here, all things that are in heaven were created by him. This word is ouranos, the Greek O-U-R-A-N-O-S. And that's where the name of our planet Uranus comes from. And if you look at the meaning, it means the sky and the abode of the stars. That's from the Greek dictionary of the New Testament. We get the same thing in Strong's Concordance if we want to look there. It's number 3772. And then that verse says, all things were made not only by Christ, but for Christ. And this is again found in Hebrews 1, 1-2. God, who at many times and in various manners spoke in the past unto the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, by whom he also made... What kind of all things are we talking about? By whom he also made the worlds. That's the New King James Version. Several translations use the words, by whom he also made the universe. Here, we can find that in the NIV, the New Living Translation, in Moffat, International Standard Version, and other versions. And this is showing the completeness of the intent of things to which Christ will be heir. Who will be co-heir with Christ of all these things? When they join his family. Amazing thing to think about. Just how long then will God's government under Christ continue to grow? Let's look in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 9. This government that God plans to start, this kingdom, how long is it going to grow? Isaiah 9, verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. Christ is going to run this government that is coming. We will be working with him. The government will be upon his shoulder. Verse 7, of the increase, the growth of that government and peace, there will be no end. It says here, for how much will this government grow? What all is God planning to do? We know that God doesn't create in vain. We're in Isaiah. Go to chapter 45. Isaiah 45 and verse 18 of this chapter. 45:18, for thus says the Lord who created the heavens. Here we are again. We're back to these heavens. Who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain. who formed it to be inhabited. These things God has made were not made in vain. When a person's will and testament is read, what do people want to know? What did I inherit? Right? What did I get? Today, and again, just for fun, let's take a look at what we've just heard will belong to Christ, which is all things, which is the world, as we read in different verses, which is the universe, as we read, of which we are described as co-heirs, which we just saw, and this was Romans 8:21, described as now in corruption, awaiting the revealing, and this is the resurrection of the children of God, and we can only imagine what all God may do with it. So I brought some slides to do this, and I love this stuff. I always said I would have been an astronomer if there was a market for astronomers, but when the whole country needs six of them, it's kind of... So, Danny, will that show up there? Yeah, okay. So, that car at the top of the slide is a 2016 Tesla. It'll go about 155 miles an hour, a very smooth driving car. And I put a line on this map from Raleigh, North Carolina to San Francisco, California. Can you see that red line? That Raleigh's where I used to live. And that's 2,545 miles. And go to MapQuest, says estimated driving time is 36 hours, 59 minutes, basically 37 hours. And that's longer than I'd usually like to be in a car. That'd be a long drive. So, next slide. Let's step it up to a 747. I guess we're going to climb on something like that tomorrow morning in the wee hours, honey. We're going to Dallas, Denver for a short visit. So this goes 500 miles per hour, and the travel time is now reduced to 5 hours on that airplane crossing the United States, but I don't want to go to San Francisco today. I'd rather go somewhere more fun. Next slide. And how long have people looked at that? And my fourth grade teacher described her life of the moon being described as a place humans would never be able to visit. So there's the moon in the sky, and I would like to go there. If we pretend we could take our same commercial jet to the moon, 500 miles per hour, how long would it take to get there? And next slide. The answer is it takes about 100 times as long. There's the jet on its way to the moon. I don't know where the moon went. Oh, is it right there? Sorry, these are a little dim. If we have the Earth the size that it is, and I think, yeah, that's the moon the size that it is, the moon would really be out there in the parking lot somewhere. These are brought closer together to make it work on typical pictures that we see. But if we could fly that airplane to the moon, it would take about 19 days of just sitting on that 747 to cover those 240,000 miles. And that, again, doesn't work very well, so we have rockets. They'll bring us there in about 3 days. Next slide. And this is a view of home base from the moon. How would it feel to be one of those who made the footprints, and you can't see them, but you can imagine in the dust there, looking back at home and realizing that your house is there, your family, your dog, and all that's going on there, and knowing that you're so very, very far from home. It's kind of an awe-inspiring picture. You'd have to be mentally strong before they send you there. I think I'd turn into Jell-O pudding or something looking back at that, thinking, where am I? I want to go to somewhere else, though. Next slide. And I wish we could make it darker, but this is a beautiful slide, and I think we might just stop for a moment and look at this. I kind of wonder, with views like this, and this is the sun here, of course, and here's the Earth, and here's Mars, and there's Jupiter and Saturn, and again, they would be much further apart, but this is kind of a God's eye view of His creation. I wonder sometimes, how big is God anyway? And I suppose the answer to that is, He's as big as He wants to be. A God's eye view of, in this artist's rendition of a part of creation, it's really a beautiful picture. What about the future co-heirs with Christ? co-heirs of the worlds, what future views will we be able to see? It's kind of something to think about. Okay, well anyway, next let's go to Mars. And Mars is right here, and that should be stretched out a bit more than it is as we plan to continue traveling out toward all eternity, heading out there in space. Next slide shows some views of Mars. And this is Mars right here. This in the circle, this is from the reconnaissance orbiter that we sent there, and a smooth landing area for the Explorer vehicle. This just shows lots of rocks and dirt, and it reminded me of the corruption that the universe is described as presently being in. And I think Danny and I struck a deal once that we'd go check this place out ourselves, but that'd be in the next stage. Can't wait. That'll be fun. And here's a view over one arm of that vehicle we put on Mars, the life-seeking probe. If we took our commercial jet to Mars, it's a 776-year trip. So that's starting to give an idea how far these planets are apart. That'd be quite a ride. Our rockets that have visited Mars, and I saw the times for at least five of them to get there, and they varied from 7 months to 12 months, depending on where Mars was, how close, when the launch occurred. And then we can start considering the other planets and how much, very much further apart they start becoming. Next slide. And this shows that artist rendition again. But here I put the distances and just said, suppose we call the distance from the Sun to Earth as one. How far are these other planets really apart? And Mars is one and a half of that. Jupiter, you see, is about five times. So we're going to have to pull it out quite a bit. And as we go all the way out to Saturn, it again, or Pluto, these are way out in the parking lot rather than the view we have here. Actually, you can see the Earth right there on this slide and the Sun right there. The Earth is really about 100 Sun diameters away from the Sun. So again, this is an artist's picture. That Earth is going to be far, far, far away to make that work. Let's bypass all those planets and just go to Pluto. Next slide shows Pluto as we travel out. This is from our New Horizons spacecraft that recently completed the 3.3 billion mile trip and sent many pictures back of this planet. Traveling at about 8 miles a second, it took a full 10 years for that spacecraft to get there. Think about 8 miles a second if you were inside that thing. And humans have been inside things going that fast. 1,001, I just did 8 miles. 1,002, I just did another. That's really moving. And at that speed, it still takes 10 years to get there. We have to go faster to talk about anything beyond the planets. Let's use the speed of light and think about reaching the stars. Next slide shows sometimes if we take a very strong laser and we shine it at Mars, it takes 4.4 minutes to get there. And that's kind of ominous when you're thinking 186,000 miles a second. But our rockets take 7 to 12 months to get there at a pretty high speed. So that's a pretty good cut down. 4 minutes. Jupiter's 35 minutes. For Pluto, it takes over 5 hours for that light to go from Earth to Pluto, traveling at that speed. And I want to go out to the stars that I sat on the driveway and looked at. But before we go, before we leave these planets, let's also compare their sizes just to see how these compare. And the next slide shows the Earth down to Pluto. Look at how much smaller Pluto is than the Earth. And here's Mercury. If we could put our moon on this slide, it would be about halfway between the size of these two planets. So the moon is called a moon because it goes around a planet, and that's what a moon is. Planets are planets because they go around the sun. So Pluto is smaller than our moon. You can see Earth and Venus are close to the same size. Next slide shows some of the bigger planets, and now look how dwarfed the Earth is beside Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. These are enormous, just enormous planets. But how big are they compared to our sun? Next slide. And you can see Earth where we live here by the sun, and even Jupiter, how much bigger this ball of fire is. And now you can imagine maybe a little bit more. If we take the diameter of the sun and go 100 of those out, then that's where the Earth really is as it's going around the sun. So that little speck is quite far out. How big is the sun compared to some of the other stars that we see in the night sky when we go outside and look? The next slide. Here's our sun. Besides some of these other stars, that thing right there says Jupiter is about one pixel in size. It's essentially invisible right there. And that the Earth cannot be seen anymore. It's so small compared to these objects. This star, Arcturus, keep the size of that in mind relative to our sun. These two as we go to the next slide. And here now is Arcturus. And the sun is almost invisible beside very huge stars like Antares, which are out in the night sky. I wonder if it's possible for a planet like the Earth to orbit something like that, to go around that, and how far out would you have to be, and how long would a year be, and how would it work? The next slide shows our sun orbiting Antares. There is a very little dot right there, and that's our sun beside this incredibly large star. And so that's what we see as we sit on our driveway and look at these different stars. And our night sky is full of stars like these. Next slide shows the night sky, and I'm afraid it's not going to be as impressive as I want, but if you can imagine just stars and stars sitting in a dark place, and I'm going to lose some of what I wanted to show, but you'll have to imagine with me. Among these stars, when you go and look at them, the closest ones are the Centauri stars. You've probably heard of Alpha Centauri, maybe. For a long time, we thought that's the closest star. The next slide shows Alpha Centauri, and this is it right here, and it's pretty bright because it's pretty close. This shows the size of Alpha Centauri beside the sun, and if we aim a telescope at this and look, we'll see it's really two stars. It's a binary, and these two rotate around each other, and they're the A and B Centauri stars. And then there was a little orange circle right about here somewhere that went around Proxima Centauri, and this is the closest star of which we're aware now. It's 4.2 light years away. Our Voyager 1 spacecraft, next slide, was launched in 1977, and it again is traveling at about 8 miles per second. 1977 is essentially 40 years ago. That it's been traveling this speed. It was the first to leave our solar system and reach interstellar space. Human-made object. Voyager 1 will take another 70,000 years to go 4.2 light years, and humans just can't travel that far. This doesn't work. That's why I've never believed in extraterrestrials. And we're talking about the closest star, and most stars in the Milky Way are 50,000 to 100,000 light years away, not 4 light years away. Distances that kind of just don't make sense, that don't compute. For our Voyager to leave our galaxy, our Milky Way, will take over 1 billion years. We don't have that much time. But wait a second. Next slide. And I'm fearful it's not going to show, but lots and lots of stars. And right in here, there is a blurry star. A little, very dim, blurry star. And if you know where to look, and Cassiopeia is over here somewhere, and another star, I forget the name, is over here, and you can draw a triangle, and you can see this blurry star with your naked eye, although it is quite dim. And astronomers realized that light from this star did something kind of weird. If you point a telescope at it and let light come through that telescope and then go through a prism, it does something called redshift. So the next slide is showing light from these different objects going through a telescope. And if we measure the redshift, oh, we got internet here. I didn't know that. Showing different redshifts, and you're connected. Then these are proportional to the distance of the object from us. And when we do all the stars around us, they're relatively close, up to 100,000 light years maybe. But this blurry star is millions and millions of light years away. And so if we point a telescope at it, next slide, shows that it starts looking like this. And it has a bright center and there's a halo all the way around it. And a bigger telescope, these are so pretty and were just too dim. The center and a halo all around it. And then scientists realized, so this is a small telescope that will show you this thing. This is a larger telescope and that's a really pretty picture of a galaxy. Scientists realized that, think if this was you and you're the first one to put this together. What I'm looking at is an entire other galaxy out there. And we've named it Andromeda. And it's Milky Way-like. It contains 200 to 400 billion stars. Estimated to be home for hundreds of billions of planets. And you know what the most remarkable thing about pictures like this, when you pull them up and look at them yourselves, and this is really bright and pretty in another room, the most remarkable thing about it is it's real. It's really out there. You can buy a 6-inch reflector telescope on eBay if you want for about $300 and point it at it, and you can verify it for yourself. And we could look at that galaxy, and what does the Bible say of us? Co-heirs with Christ, co-heirs of all things, of the worlds, of the universe. And I was going to say, look, there's a big galaxy right there. Here's another one. The astronomer said as they pointed a bigger telescope at this, said, look, there is another one showing up. And the more we look, the more we find. The next slide shows four different galaxies. These are showing up a little bit better that our telescopes can be pointed at. Each of these just huge, huge things. And I put a prop in my pocket. It's a dime. You might have heard of the Hubble Deep Space View. If you back away from this dime until you're 50 feet away, that's how big the piece of sky is that this next slide is looking at. And this is Hubble Telescope, and it was focused on that dime-sized piece of sky for a long time so that it could keep collecting light. And this is probably the most inspiring picture I've ever seen. And it's not terrible here, but it could be better. It looks kind of like the night sky all over again, except for every object in this slide is a whole other galaxy. And in some of these regions, maybe we can kind of appreciate, and you can pull up the real one by just Googling Hubble Deep Space View. These little dots get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and they're everywhere, and they're entire galaxies that we're looking at in that small piece of space. And by multiplying up the size of that space, scientists calculate we can see somewhere between 100 and 200 billion. Not stars, but galaxies, each containing 100, 200, 400 billion stars, each containing planets galore. More Milky Way-like objects than the number of humans who have ever existed. And so we'll be occupying bodies that will be like Christ's at our resurrection. So now let's consider a resurrection related question. And this gets interesting to me. Will all resurrected first fruits be the same? When we're resurrected, we know as humans now we're all different, right? Will we all be the same? And maybe a related question, will we be done growing when we're resurrected? And I am speculating some because God hasn't spelled it all out yet. But you will still be you, but much more powerful and no longer subject to sin or corruption. And I'm asking the question, will we be able to grow? And to me, it's an interesting question. Let's look in Luke 19. Will we be different? Will we all be the same? Where is God bringing us? Where are we going? Luke 19. In verse 12, so this is a parable here, Luke 19:12. Therefore he said, and this is Christ talking to them, a certain nobleman, and we know this represents Christ, went into a far country, and we know this represents heaven, to receive for himself a kingdom after he qualified by displacing Satan, and to return, and that's the second coming. Verse 13, before he left, so he called 10 of his servants, that's us in the church, and delivered to them 10 minas, that's God's Holy Spirit being delivered, and they each got one, and said to them, do business till I come. So that's what we're doing now in God's church. We're growing our Holy Spirit, our mina. In verse 15, and so it was that when he returned, having received the kingdom, this is the second coming of Christ, he then commanded these servants, okay, this is us, to whom he had given the Holy Spirit the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Then came the first, saying, Master, your mina, your gift has earned 10 times. 10 minas. And Christ said to him, well done, good servant, because you are faithful in very little, you have authority now over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Master, your mina has earned 5 minas. And this is what we've always taught, and it's what we're aware of, and it's what we understand. The message seems clear here that we will receive different levels of responsibility when Christ returns and with our resurrection. Different levels of authority. So Renee, you get 10 cities, and Jim, you get 5 cities, and Steve Holiday, not Steve Elliott. You see this guy over here, Joe? You watch his dog while he's at work. So the Bible talks about different levels of authority in the resurrection. Then I would like to ask, could there be a related difference in the spirit bodies that we occupy at the first resurrection? Different glory levels, if you will, of those spirit bodies. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians. So I don't think I'm speculating about anything right now, but I will, and just for fun, because I think God wants us to think about these things and what he's offering. And we'll be even more surprised when we get there. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 40. Verse 40. There are also celestial bodies. And there's a little one here in my Bible, and if I look in the middle, it says heavenly. Heavenly bodies. We're talking about the things we've been looking at out here. There are heavenly bodies. And then there are terrestrial ones back on the earth. And what we're comparing is spirit beings, God beings, to humans who aren't yet God beings. But the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is a big difference between a spirit being and a physical human. There's one glory of the sun. There's another glory of the moon. And another glory of the stars. And each star differs one from another. And we were looking at the stars and the size of our sun compared to the size of other stars. There are different glories of these things, says Paul. And then look where he goes with it in the next verse. So also is the resurrection. He's telling us there are different glories here. And this is apparently matching the parable of Christ we just read in Luke, where the reward is based on our works, our growth. And I haven't heard a lot about that, so it was interesting to me as I was looking and seeing Paul describe different levels of glory, just like the celestial bodies that we just looked at. Whether we inherit 5 cities, or 10 cities, or the glory of one of the brighter stars, or one of the dimmer stars. And the next slide, I think, shows the number of these stars as they compare in size. And Paul says they're all different in their glory. So shall it be in the resurrection. Here's something we don't know much about, and it's interesting for me to think about. Will the dimmer stars stay dimmer for all eternity? I've suspected it's unlikely that spirit children of God, if initially resurrected to a lower level of glory, you know, I get to watch Joe's dog, will be locked into that lower level of glory for all eternity. I don't have any verses I can go to, and I'm just pondering what God may be doing. But think about it. If someone was called 6 months before they died, how could they achieve works comparable to a minister who spent 50 years working, trading with his mina, devoting that time to preaching and teaching God's people, or to a faithful widow who helped and prayed and served those same 50 years? Does it seem likely that God's children, his family members, would be locked into a lower level of glory, a dim star for all eternity, endless billions of years based on the short duration of a human life? I don't know. We've read a lot, I think, that was clear, but then it kind of leads me to this. If we're resurrected at different levels of glory, where do we go as we go through all eternity, endless billions of years after this short human life we've had, and different circumstances under which we are called? And I'm speculating where God may be bringing us. Consider again when you're first resurrected and you begin working with Christ. You know, we could say that God gives you a smart pill and the Bible's all in your head. Or we could suppose that as we teach people and read the Bible, we learn more about it too. And maybe you can read the Bible in 5 minutes then as a spirit being. I don't know. But when you're first resurrected and begin working with Christ in the millennium, how much will we learn from Christ during those 1,000 years where he says, you know, we revealed a lot to you before you were resurrected, but there's a lot more to this plan, and here's where we're going. Here's where we're going. How much more will we learn working with Christ for 1,000 years, listening to what he tells us about the plan of God, where God intends to bring his family? Well, learning is the most important kind of growth there is. So if we do grow, then the glory increases and the dim stars get brighter. Possibly, I don't know, but I often wonder if spirit children will continue to do what physical children do after our resurrection, and that's continue growing to become more and more like our Father. Not forever dimmer, perhaps. If you were called not too long before you were resurrected and were one of the lower glory stars as described by Paul, and then you wonder, what might we look like in terms of glory after spending 1,000 years with Christ, after our resurrection? Will our glory have increased, our brightness, because we've been with Christ that long? And then you have to go forward. What might we be like after participating in the growth of God's kingdom, and that kingdom that will increase forever, working under God for 10,000 years? What might we be like after living with and growing to be like God for 10 million years under our Father, the God? And sometimes I wonder, it's kind of like looking at the galaxies. I think I have a slide of a galaxy next, but I fear how dim it might be, and it's such a beautiful thing. Sometimes I wonder, looking at things like this, just what kind of future is it that we're really being offered by our Father after reading about the worlds and the heavens and the universe that we're co-heirs to? Just what kind of future is it we're being offered, and how amazing might it truly be? So I'll close in 1 Corinthians 2. We're kind of still in 1 Corinthians if you didn't close. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 7. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory. And here we are, the glory, and the glory of God's children, and the family he's making, and it's all about glory. The magnificence, the beauty that resembles that of God himself. Verse 8, which none of the rulers of this age knew, and they don't. And our politicians, they don't. Had they known in Paul's age here, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The Lord of glory. Verse 9, but as it is written, just what all is God offering us? Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Let's never let go of this amazing calling to enter the family of God and be co-heirs with Christ of all things, and accept the magnificent glory that God intends to build in each of us.